Please remain standing for the reading of the Gospel. This is the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 14, verses 25 to 33. Now large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and he turned and said to them, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and even life itself, cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost to see whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has finished, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going out to wage war against another king, will not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? If he cannot, then, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for the terms of peace. So therefore, none of you can become my disciple if you do not give up all your possessions." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Have you ever asked the question, what have I gotten myself into? I did that a few months ago. It wasn't the first time. Usually, I do that at some point in my yard projects. This time, my yard was dug up once again. I had bought some drain pipes, hoping to fix a soggy area in my yard. I started digging a trench, and I soon realized I had to go deeper and longer than I thought. I remember standing in the yard and asking, "What have I done?" Somehow, I convinced my kids to help me ditch digging. And quite a few weeks later, it was all done. Some of you are gifted at planning to the utmost detail, at thinking through every contingency. If I had led the Stand in the Gap campaign, we would have successfully ripped off the siding, probably gotten a few cans of paint from Home Depot, but then hit a few or many roadblocks and snags along the way. And we will be the laughingstock of the residents at Churchill Estates who look at us from the window, or the high schoolers who this week will start skateboarding by. Look at them. They couldn't even finish the siding. Well, I'm grateful for Stan and others who planned this all out, that you never had to deal with that issue. Our text today gives us a similar image, but focusing on counting the cost of following Jesus. Now, the text I read is a shocker. It's hard. But it's not hard because of obscure Greek phrases or something like that, but because it's hard to live out. This passage is full of vivid image, vivid language and illustrations. And as I read it, you might have heard a phrase repeated three times: "Unless this, you cannot be my disciple. Unless you hate your loved ones, you cannot be my disciple. Unless you carry a cross, you cannot be my disciple. Unless you give up everything, you cannot be my disciple," Jesus says. At its core, this passage in the Gospel asks, what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? Now, some of you have been told in parts of the church that all you need to do to follow Jesus is raise your hand when every head is bowed and every eye is closed, or that we need to fill out a card or say a prayer. Or for some, it was getting baptized, a membership class, confirmation, confession, and communion. For many outside Oregon, they might feel like, well, I grew up in America, and I like baby Jesus at Christmas, so I'm probably a Christian. So they fill out those surveys and they check the Christian box. But some of us have been told that to be a good Christian, you must go to church every week and give money regularly, which also is a good thing, but I'm not saying don't give. But, we also think, oh, if I help on the work days, if I do the dishes over there now and then I'm a good Christian. Some of us have heard that to be a good Christian means we don't hang out with certain people. Or we only vote a certain way. Or we avoid certain types of music. Or we stop dancing, card playing, or chewing tobacco. In 1937, the esteemed German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote the book, The Cost of Discipleship. To be honest, if you don't remember anything I say, remember this. This is a wonderful handling of this text. And I encourage you to read it multiple times. I try to read it once a year if I can. In those days when he was writing in 1937, the main Protestant churches in Germany were telling people that to be a good Christian, one had to support the Nazi government. Bonhoeffer strongly disagreed, and he led an underground seminary to train confessing church pastors. This book is a product of some of his teaching there. And it's very poignant that this book he wrote is The Cost of Discipleship. And 8 years later, he was killed by the Nazis in 1945. In his introduction, he says this, quote, "The trouble is that the pure word of Jesus has been overlaid with so much human ballast, burdensome rules and regulations, false hopes and consolations, that it has become extremely difficult to make a genuine decision for Christ. Does not our preaching contain too much of our own opinions and convictions and too little of Jesus Christ?" This passage in Luke challenges us to push away the fluff and the weeds that have overgrown around the center of our faith. Jesus is warning potential disciples as he speaks to the crowd, but it's a reminder to all of us who've already started the journey that it's necessary to follow Jesus to the end. Do we have it what it takes to follow Jesus today until our dying breath? Jesus tells us three things that are required. First, he says, if we do not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even our own life, we cannot be his disciple. How do we hear that? The conventional way we use the word hate is usually a profound dislike, a visceral contempt of a person or thing, maybe even an addictive sort of anger or an obsessive opposition. We might be tempted to hate a bully at school, or the drunk driver who hit our car, or the politician on the other side of the aisle. Or we say we hate doing the dishes, or eating salami, or something like that. There's also newer sensitivities around that word today. Today there's talk of hate crimes and hate speech. The U.S. Department of Justice defines hate in the legal sense as a bias against people or groups with specific characteristics that are defined by the law. Hate crime laws include crimes committed on the basis of the victim's perceived or actual race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, or disability. Jesus is not calling us to this kind of hate either. But nevertheless, as we hear his words, they sound very harsh. They feel contrary to our natural feelings to care for our family and our friends. They feel contrary to our filial, marital, and parental obligations. They seem to contradict Jesus' call for us to love our neighbor, or Moses' law that says we should honor our father and mother. When I read this, Jesus sounds pretty anti-family. But we have to remember the context of Jesus' speech. He's talking to the crowd. And when Jesus preached widely, he spoke more enigmatically, metaphorically, hyperbolically even, and in this setting, radically. He spoke in a way to get people's attention, to shock them out of complacency, such as the passage in John where he tells people to eat his flesh and drink his blood. Another shocking passage we don't have time for today. If we compare this passage to other pieces of Jesus' teaching, we come across Matthew 10:37, where he says, quote, "Anyone who loves their father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." This sounds more palatable. If we compare these passages, I think Jesus is using the word hate in Luke as an attention-getting, hyperbolic way. I think what Jesus is doing here is catching us off guard and reminding us how deep and profound our love for him should be. He says that to follow him, we must put those we love as second. We must set our affections in proper proportion. Our love of God must be greater than all human loves. In other words, when we put family, friends, and even ourselves as more important than Jesus, it's idolatry. This passage challenges us. Do we love our family in a God-shaped way? Or is our love of family merely an extension of self-love? Many of us can be tempted to shape family events or relationships in a way that make us look good, or train our children up in a way that makes us look good and feel good about ourselves, but not necessarily Jesus' way. There are times when family can come between us and God. Whether non-Christian family members who don't understand our beliefs or make fun of our fuddy-duddy lifestyle, or the temptation parents might have to worry and tempt children away from following God's call to serve in dangerous places. Jesus is clear that God's kingdom must be paramount and everything else is second. That everything in our life should be questioned in light of Christ and his call to us. Look at the disciples. They left their fishing boat and their tax collecting booth. They quit their jobs to follow Jesus. Has God ever called us to that? Simon the Zealot had to change his politics. Has God ever called us to do that? Many of the disciples were away from their families for extended periods of time, without cell phones, without Zoom calls, following Jesus. And we've heard stories over the centuries of Christian history where monks and missionaries brought the gospel to new places, leaving all previous attachments aside. And those that they say goodbye to, in some ways it looked like they hated their family. They were leaving all that they had loved for Jesus. And this past month, we focused on missions, and we've heard wonderful missionary stories about bringing Christ to other cultures in ways that honor their cultural identity. And yet we've heard missionary stories in the past where unenlightened Christians went to indigenous groups in Africa, North and South America, telling them to abandon too much of their music, culture, and family ties for the sake of the gospel. There's a lot written about critiquing these past approaches. But do we ever stop and ask ourselves what we need to give up in our own world? In these days, there's a lot of critique and questioning of white culture. And I think all of us in here, I believe, are white. There's a lot of good and beautiful things that white people have done. I'm a sucker for large German symphonies like Mahler or Beethoven. But are we able to hold white culture up to the plumb line of Christ and recognize that we are secondary? Are we able to hold our ways of doing things loosely, being willing to let go of them when called to love our neighbor of a different culture? What pressures do we get from family and friends that distract us from a single-minded devotion to Christ? There is much we need to let go of to keep following Jesus, to make it to the end. Buddhism talks about letting go of attachments. And while its insights have helped people as far as they go, Jesus is not asking us to be completely unattached. but rather he calls us to an exclusive attachment to him. An exclusive attachment to him. For example, we should still grieve when a relative dies, and we should still delight in the laughter of our children. But our attachment to Christ is such that our connection with him nourishes us more than any previous attachment could. When he uses the word hate, I see him saying, put everything secondary to me. Hold everything loosely in comparison to me. That includes ourselves. Now I want to make a special note about this. Jesus said in this passage, we must hate our own life or our own soul. Is Jesus saying that spiritual maturity looks like self-loathing, flagellating myself on the inside, calling myself a worm or chief of sinners all the time? No. Psalm 139 is still true, that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, intricately woven in our mother's womb. Genesis 1 says we're created in the image of God. We are sacred creations of God, but we must not look at ourselves the way the world does. Often people are framed as heroes, whether it's stories of Spider-Man, signs of healthcare workers, or in sentimental songs like Wind Beneath My Wings, where Bette Midler sings, did you ever know that you're my hero? Often we seek to be the hero in our own story, even with our own Achilles' heels. This way of thinking, we make ourselves the center of the universe, which is a problem. The Bible is not against a healthy self-esteem, but it is against esteeming ourselves more highly than we ought. We must renounce our sovereignty, permit every part of our life to be governed by God's will. This is the core of spiritual life. And to do this with gratitude for God's grace, candor regarding our weakness, and peace about our future is the mark of maturity. It's not simply let go and let God, but it's an increasing growing and deepening in our connection with Christ. Honestly, I think we're tempted to be superficial in our identity, to place my identity in my job or activities or accomplishments or my family or the Oregon Ducks. There was a wound yesterday for those who watch those things, or the Beavers for that matter. Sometimes we're tempted to shape our identity and our feelings. What am I passionate about? Who am I attracted to? How do I respond to the person I see in the mirror? But what if our identity is deeper than this? What if we let Jesus shape our identity? What if we get so close to our Creator that we begin to live out His design for us? What if we realized how much we are loved? How He wants to form us and restore His image in us? What if we pursue deep union with Christ over mere outward conformity to rules? What if we, the created, could experience and participate in the life of the uncreated Master? Jesus calls us in this passage from security in this tangible, calculatable world to the seeming ambiguous insecurity of following the invisible God. Although in fact, He is the absolute security and safety for us. He calls us from a finite-shaped world to one led by the infinite God. In my ministry Peace Health, I work with a lot of older adults as a chaplain. And they tell me how hard it is to let go of a functional body, to let go of independence, and that feeling of productivity that the world praises so much. The wiser seniors have taught me, they've taught me a lot about leaning on Jesus and how that can help us in hardships. And how as we have less and less of our own strength to depend on, God's strength becomes greater. One lady I met a few years ago, I visited her on a regular basis, and she struggled to walk. She had constant arthritic pain, and she needed increased help as dementia was setting in. Yet she said that her daily goal was to walk down the hall outside her room and bless somebody in some way. She was always looking to bless somebody. Her sense of mission was stronger than her limitations. Jesus' call forces us to be put in a place where faith is possible, where we don't rely on others or even ourselves for our identity and security. We must put aside the past self, or as Bonhoeffer says in his famous line, when Christ calls a man, he bids him to come and die. The second requirement of discipleship is carrying the cross. This phrase is paradigmatic, for the cross is the center of the Christian symbolism and story. We've all heard it. We've heard people talk about the cross that they have to bear in various ways. And probably one of the more crass ways, John Lennon saying, you know, it ain't easy. You know how hard it can be. The way things are going, they're going to crucify me. And he was talking about just media pressure in his own lifestyle. Jesus said to follow him, we must carry our cross. Does this just mean we're going to have hard times? The image and usage in this way is so common in our world, it feels useless to rally against it. But I don't think this is the core of what Jesus is talking about, that we're going to have a rough time of it. Look afresh at what it means. The cross was an execution device, a torturous instrument of capital punishment. For the Jews, it was a painful sign of the oppressive regime of Rome, their abuses of power, their fear-mongering and bloody propaganda. It was a reminder that the Jews still felt in exile in their own land, with few rights and freedom. Most crucifixions involved convicted persons carrying the crossbeam on their shoulders from where they were sentenced to the place of execution. Jesus' statement had real meaning for its audience. It wasn't merely a poignant foreshadow. Most of his audience had seen a convict doing this, walking down the road, carrying their public shame, and displaying the empire's triumph over them. Note Jesus' phrasing. We are the ones carrying the cross, and it's our cross that we carry. Let's be honest as we imagine ourselves in this picture. Can we claim that we're innocent like Jesus as we carry our cross after him? Maybe part of this image is Jesus calling us to bring ourselves to execution. We are the guilty ones. As that famous verse in Romans says, the wages of sin is death. We deserve to be carrying our own cross beam, for our actions and attitudes, both past and present, many times rebel against God. That's why we confess our sins before coming to the Lord's table today. So in this, as Jesus calls us to carry the cross, we need to be honest about our sin. We need to have a daily regular habits of acknowledging our weaknesses, that we're sinners. Be quick to say I'm sorry. Be open to critique and feedback, and recognize our contribution to systemic sins in our city and country. And we can do this because by acknowledging our sin, we know the end of the story, that Jesus will raise us up. And as we carry our cross, it's not just our individual actions and regrets, but the consequences of our sin that we carry as we follow him. We must not only own up to the pain that we caused others, but Jesus' call requires us to do the work of restoring where we can, to pay the price of restitution. One reformer painted an image of all of us bound to our crosses, Christian or not. Those not following Jesus try to shake off their cross, but they can't, as they head towards their destination of destruction. We can carry our cross in Christ with hope in the one we're following. I think of the story of Christian in that famous book, Pilgrim's Progress, where he carries that heavy burden up to the cross. And once he gets there, that burden is released and never to be seen again. Second Jesus' call in this is to follow him. I do believe this verse is an allusion to his death. The world praises him as a wise moral teacher in one of the world's largest religions. But when people start putting his teaching into practice, history shows that it ends in rejection, persecution, and martyrdom. If we are following the wisdom that gets crucified, let us not be surprised when people don't like when we repeat his teachings. Jesus says we must be prepared to endure afflictions. If they hated me, they will hate you also. We are not above our teacher. As Christians, we don't play the martyr, but rather we should be prepared to be a true martyr if Jesus calls. Jesus makes clear the path is hard. And then the final image, we're given an extended construction scenario. When I first read it about building towers and everything, I thought, well, who builds towers anymore? But then I realized the only towers that we build today are cell towers. In those days, it was building a watchtower to look out for fires or watch for enemies. Maybe a rancher would put a tower to see where his sheep or cattle are grazing in the far distant hills or something like that. But aside from the specific image, if we step back, we know how important financial planning is, especially in our economy of inflation and supply chain issues. And Jesus also gives us this image of a king preparing for battle. We hear this sort of thing in political discourse when candidates talk about how tax money is spent and how much this war cost or that one did. And when they talk about current events, will an army be fully prepared to achieve its goals? And after Jesus lays out these nice proverbial wisdom stories on planning, cost estimates, and resource allocation, he goes for the jugular. What does it cost to follow Jesus? Not build a tower or go to war. What's the cost of following Jesus? Well, everything. When preachers have told us, give your life to Jesus, did we really know what they were talking about? Your life? Everything? Are we willing to give our lifestyle to Jesus, changing what we read or watch or spend time doing? Are we willing to give our family life to Jesus? Are we willing to give our financial life to him, our physical life? Jesus isn't talking just theoretically, as the martyrs proved over history. Of course, when we share the gospel with others, it's good news, but we should also emphasize its cost. Grace is free, but following Jesus is not. He calls us to give up everything, give our life to Jesus, and everything attached to our life. He might not ask us to sell our house tomorrow, but we must not be too attached to it. We must hold it loosely. It's to be used for the Lord and not just for ourselves. We must prepare our hearts to say goodbye to it someday. When I've talked to survivors of the McKinsey River fires a few years ago, or older adults who have had to downsize because they can't drive or climb stairs, a few godly ones have said to me, you know, it's just stuff. So I'd encourage you to go home and look at your stuff. Pray about it. Pray through each room of the house. Say, God, this is yours. It's not mine. I'm going to have to say goodbye to it one day. Even the most precious things. Can we say all that we have really belongs to Jesus? Or as the psalmist says, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. That means our world too, not just the globe. It also means our health, our memory, our cognition. It's the Lord's. And if disease takes it away, can we still follow Jesus? Those of you who do not give up everything cannot be my disciples, Jesus said. Now, when I turn on the TV, they tell me to make life better. I need to add something to my life. Get a new car. Get a new hair product. I don't have much to put product on. Or at least it's diminishing. Or have a new experience of something exotic, especially on a cruise boat somewhere. It seems, though, that Jesus' definition of the good life has more to do with letting go of things, seeing what we need to remove. It's a good practice to regularly ask, not just during Lent, what can I let go of? What's unnecessary? What's in the way? As I conclude, I want to remind us that Jesus' call is difficult because it requires everything of us. Letting go of our family, our dreams, our comfort, our possessions seems impossible. Is it just for the spiritual elite, the monks and nuns who could leave their family, marriage, marital possessions behind and take extra punishments? No. Jesus is talking to you and me in the day-to-day world. Jesus warns us, I believe, because he wants us to be prepared for the road ahead, for ourselves and those around us. Some people we know have relaxed their zeal for Christ, compromised their actions and beliefs in cowardice, and won't endure a cross-shaped life. While some people aren't Christians because of the pain of the church's sins, and that's a different conversation, some people reject Jesus because following him can feel harsh and unpleasant. But Jesus wouldn't call us unless he knew we could make it. Not by ourselves, of course, but by his help. He wants us to make it. He said in Matthew 11, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Jesus' way is not soft and it's not safe, but he travels it with us, training us all the way. It's not so much how we start that matters as how we finish. I believe that as we take small steps towards letting go and holding things lightly, we grow in our devotion, and eventually, when God calls us to give up something big, such as someone we love or a large fortune or bodily health, we can do it. I believe that God has created us to be what some authors call anti-fragile. Jonathan Haidt and Nassim Taleb speak about this. And Taleb writes in one of his books that there are three types of things. Three types of coping, you could say. Things that are as fragile as a teacup, and it breaks, and it can't be repaired. There are things that are resilient and can withstand pressure and remain the same. And then the third, the anti-fragile things that grow and improve with pressure. One example is our immune system that requires stressors and challenges in order for it to learn and grow and keep us healthy. I believe our spiritual life is like this. When we don't nourish our soul, when we don't challenge ourselves, when we focus solely on pleasure and comfort, we atrophy within. We become soft and undiscerning, or brittle and weak. Jesus' teaching here is an antidote for that. The more often we make habits of counting the cost, letting go of stuff, taking the cross we carry towards where Jesus is going, and making loved ones' priorities second to Jesus, the more we find God's strength at work in us, God's instincts driving us, God's life blessing others through us. Bonhoeffer in his book asks, "If we answer the call to discipleship, where will it lead us? We shall have to go to him, for only he knows the answer. Only Jesus Christ, who bids us to follow him, knows the journey's end. But we do know that it will be a road of boundless mercy. Discipleship means joy. 8 years after he wrote that, on New Year's Day in 1945, a few months before his death, Bonhoeffer found himself sitting alone in a Gestapo prison in Berlin. Around him were despicable conditions and cries of other inmates becoming unhinged from the harsh conditions and torture. And as he sat there, he wrote a poem, "Who Am I?" And I'll close by reading the last portion of his poem. "Who am I? They tell me I bore the days of my misfortune equably, smilingly, proudly, like one accustomed to win. Am I then really that which other men tell of? Or am I only what I myself know of myself? Restless and longing and sick, like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath as though hands were compressing my throat, yearning for colors, for flowers, for the voices of birds, thirsting for words of kindness, for neighborliness, tossing in expectations of great events, powerlessly trembling for friends at an infinite distance, weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making, faint and ready to say farewell to it all. Who am I, this or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once, a hypocrite before others and before myself, a contemptible, woebegone weakling? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine."